think there is a war on science? Our guest does, and he says it's being waged on three fronts. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, July 8th. We will find out who is waging the war on science, according to our guest, and what can be done about it. And we'll welcome your questions and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sean Otto. He was the organizer and producer of the last two U.S. presidential science debates in 2008 and 2012. He's also a screenwriter and author, and his newest book is The War on Science: Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Well, let's start by talking about the phrase, the war on science. That's certainly one we've heard tossed around in the media quite a bit in recent years. But what does that mean when you use it?
Well, there is a specific set of attacks that are going on to undermine the public's perception of the value of science and evidence in making public policy. And it's coming, as you said, from three fronts. But there's a very concerted effort by what I call the industrial war on science, where they're spending about $1 billion a year to do that. So it's a very distinct thing that I'm referring to.
All right. Well, let's talk about those three fronts. You'd mentioned the industrial war on science, what is that comprised of?
The industrial war on science is run by corporations whose business models are being undermined by advances in environmental and health sciences. And rather than adapt their business model, it sometimes is more cost-effective to mount public disinformation campaigns to forestall or prevent regulations that they don't like.
Yeah, for example, what's one of the misinformation campaigns that you can cite?
Well, one of the biggest ones that's going on right now is the battle against climate regulation, anything to do with cap and trade or carbon tax. Even though the science in this area is overwhelming that the climate is changing and that humans are the predominant cause of that, there is a very large, as I said, about $1 billion a year being invested in public relations campaigns to create phony science and support groups that promulgate that science and get it out there in the public to confuse the public and forestall the legislative process.
So how does the industrial war on science differ from another front, the ideological war on science?
Well, the ideological war on science really has been around as long as science has been around in its modern form, dating back to when the Catholic Church prosecuted Galileo for saying that after he looked through the telescope that he made, it looked pretty much like Copernicus was right, that the Earth was going around the sun and not the other way around. And they indicted him, saying that this was an absurd conclusion and that it was challenging their authority. And this is really where the conflict, classic conflict between science and biblically literalist religious persons has emanated from. It's always about origins, and when science creates new knowledge, sometimes that causes or comes into conflict with a literalist interpretation of the Bible and where people come from or the beginning of life. So we always see conflicts around issues like the question of evolution or the Big Bang or human control of the reproductive process. All of these things are about origins, which biblical literalists consider God's territory.
Yeah. And then the third front that you cite for the war on science is the identity politics war on science. Whatever is that?
Yeah, that one might be a little bit more confusing to people, particularly on the left, who consider themselves often more pro-science than those on the right. But a lot of the philosophical groundwork for the modern public relations war on science, particularly being emanated or being promulgated by the industrial actors, comes from a movement in academia starting in the 1970s called postmodernism, where science was taught, particularly, as I said, in humanities, just as one other equally valid way of knowing. This part of this is denying that there is any such thing as objective knowledge. So when you think of modern identity politics, we talk about black truth, gender-based truth, LGBT truth, and all of these things are considered equally valid ways of knowing. And what the identity politics war did was it lumped science in as just another form of identity, as just another subjective experience, making it political. But that's the exact opposite of what science was designed to do. The whole point of science is to pull what we know out from all those political identities. So when we say a fact, it's true no matter the gender or the political identity or the sexual orientation of the person doing the measuring. So in that sense, science is really the most fundamental force for civil rights that we have. But what this did was it created a intellectual foundation for instance, for journalism schools to teach for the last two decades that there is no such thing as objectivity. And if journalists believe that, as many of them do, it forces an overemphasis on what we call balance, one of the principles of journalism, where journalists wind up putting a climate scientist speaking with objective knowledge in one half of the story or on one half of the television screen, and somebody with an opinion on the other half acting as if they're the same thing, yeah. And they're not.
And we'll get more into that, too. But here's a comment from Jamie on Facebook, which I think goes into this identity politics war on science that you mentioned. This is not an entirely partisan matter, he writes. There are plenty of people who refuse to accept the science behind GMOs, energy production options. I'm guessing he thinks nuclear, that a lot of people on the left object to nuclear power when science says, for the most part, it might be just fine, and other issues that don't fit into their politicized ideology. Both political parties in the U.S. show little respect for any semblance of economic science. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that what he's saying is absolutely right. What happened in the 1970s was a split really occurred in the United States around science issues, where religious conservatives found themselves in common cause with old industry, the petrochemical industry. The conservatives in the religious side or the ideological side were offended by the pill and by teaching of evolution and our advances in control over human reproduction. And on the left, people became inordinately, sometimes with good cause, but concerned about hidden dangers to health and the environment. And the problem is when these things become politicized, then people don't use evidence as a basis for making opinion, and they extend it based on political ideology. And what we've seen then is a lot of unfounded suspicion on the left about these hidden dangers. So the idea that vaccines may cause autism when there's absolutely no evidence, the overwhelming evidence in fact shows they don't, that cell phones may cause brain cancer, or that GMO crops are unsafe to eat.
We are talking with our guest, Sean Otto, who is the author of The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a reaction to what you're hearing or a question or a view. So now we know some of who is waging the war on science. What do you see as the consequences of the war on science? The why does it matter?
Well, excuse me, it matters because science is really the foundation of Western democracy. When Thomas Jefferson was sitting for those 17 days in that hot, sweaty, rented room that he had outside of Philadelphia and was working on the Declaration of Independence, he had to come up with an argument that would convince other nations in Europe, Enlightenment nations, not to intercede in the Revolutionary War. And his argument essentially boiled down to Enlightenment thinking that if anyone can find the truth of something for him or herself using the tools of science and reason, then no king, no pope, and no wealthy lord is more entitled to rule than we the people are. So we have that qualification that pitted facts against entrenched power, and it based democracy on the idea that facts exist and that we should make policy based on evidence and that the people themselves are the best source of finding those facts. So when we see attacks on science, they're really attacks on our ability to govern ourselves by entrenched interests who don't like what the evidence of science is saying.
I was just going to say that we will continue our discussion on the war on science, who's waging it, why it matters, and what we can do about it after this break. And we'll welcome more of your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sean Otto. He was the organizer and producer of the last two U.S. presidential science debates in 2008 and 2012. And he is also the author of The War on Science. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Sean Otto, who is the author of The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We're going to start with Maddie in Oneida. Hi, Maddie.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I totally disagree with this guy. I do definitely believe in science. I do. But science where the truth exists. Over in Europe, they don't feed GMO food to their kids. The corn kills bugs that eat it instantly. The soybeans emit formaldehyde with regard to the shots. People should go on the internet and look up Andrew Wakefield on his lecture, Leadership and Longevity.
Maddie, thank you very much. Well, what about that, Sean, talk some about this. Maddie says she's a science believer, but she thinks that the jury is still out when it comes to GMOs and that, don't we have conflicting science sometimes?
Yeah, well, in the case of GMO foods, the science really isn't conflicting. There is actually a larger consensus of scientists that say that GMO food is safe to eat than there are that say that climate change is real and that humans are causing it. So it's actually more foundational and more strongly supported. But people don't often want to hear that. Now, there's a very distinct, interesting question here because there's a political issue that's becoming conflated with the science here, and we're watching it happen. Politically, there's a legitimate question about whether or not a corporation like Monsanto should control a genome or own all the profit from certain kinds of planting, say. And there is a legitimate environmental question about whether we should be planting crops that are resistant to certain pesticides that cause them to be overused and cause superbugs to evolve then, or superweeds. But those are not questions about whether it's safe to eat, when in fact genetic modification is something we've been doing for as long as we've been people. We just have learned how to do it more precisely.
Yeah. And you say that we may incorporate evidence from science into the policy making and political processes, and that is broken, that process is broken. Talk more about why you say that process is broken.
Well, I think that Maddie's point about you can go look on the internet is a really good example of that. Right now, there's so much information available, and people can go find what seems to be science on the Internet. And it's hard to really tell the difference sometimes between what is science and what is not. We're all busy in our lives. We're not professional scientists. So then it comes down to learning how to go find primary sources and how to make decisions and not be confused by PR campaigns.
Yeah. How many of our policymakers actually have a background in science?
Oh, it's really low. It's less than 2%. At least when you're talking professional background, there's one physicist, one microbiologist, one chemist, and six engineers. So that's it in out of 535 people. And the dangerous thing about this is that we're living in a time when science impacts every aspect of life on the planet and has major things to say about most public policy issues at this point. And yet, members of Congress have abolished their science advisory body, the Office of Technology Assessment. So they're really flying blind on a lot of these issues, relying on what they hear from lobbyists and the Internet.
Yeah. So taking this one step further, do we need to get more scientists involved with politics?
Absolutely, we do. You know, back before the creation of the National Science Foundation in 1957, well, that's really when it was funded anyway, scientists had to do a lot of public outreach to get support for their work. And there was a much closer bond between them and the public. And that really changed when scientists didn't need to appeal to the public for money so directly. So one of the best things that scientists can do is get involved in public outreach again and help bridge that bond so that the public, they don't have to understand the details of science, but they have to understand the thought processes that are involved so they realize that this is the best thinking that we are able to develop on a subject right now.
Yeah. Well, but scientists are human. Mistakes are made. Science isn't perfect. Science evolves. What's wrong with a little skepticism about the information that's presented to us?
Oh, that's actually always a thank you for asking. It's a really good thing. We always have to be skeptical. And people like to point to, for instance, the different diet studies that always come out. And it's easy for companies pushing one product or another to come up with bogus science even there. So it gets back to that question of how do you discern what's really true? How do you know that eating chocolate or drinking red wine it really is good for you?
Yeah.
And that's why we have to rely on the process of science and how the public really needs to learn to discern good science from bad science. And part of the way that we do that is by getting it to be a more central part of our political discussion, like complex economics or foreign policy.
Yeah. But, yeah, I talk a little bit more about, you know, good science versus bad science. We had good scientists telling us, you know, about, for example, food pyramid and nutritional information, and all of that has changed in many ways. So there have been good scientists that at the time made what they thought were good decisions, but it's changed.
And that's the way that science always is. It's creatively disruptive because we don't really know absolutely everything about anything. So science is always provisional, and it's honest about that, unlike other assertions that we might make where we say this is true no matter what. Science will always say, to the best of our evidence at this point, this is what appears to be the best thing to do. So we make provisional judgments based on evidence, and science continues to progress, and those judgments may change over time, and in fact they have as we get more evidence and we learn more. And that's the beautiful thing about science, is that it's never static. It's never finally concluded on anything.
Well, then what about those who would argue, hey, maybe all the climate scientists say that climate change is man-made and that the world is warming and that this is going to have dire consequences, but maybe they're not right.
Mm-hmm. That's where we get into consensus and the peer review process. And the relative level of support the different scientific statements may have. A lot of times, for instance, in a dietary study, it will be one single study, and it'll make headlines around the world because it's interesting and sexy, and people are interested in their health and diet. But climate science is not like that. Climate science is literally tens of thousands of studies being done by tens of thousands of scientists over more than a century now, working with billions of data points. So it's a completely different thing. It's like one pea versus all the peas in the world. And the vast majority of those experiments are all pointing in the same direction. And that's why we can conclude with much greater certainty there than in a dietary study that, in fact, humans are causing climate change.
Let's go to Mary in Chippewa Falls. Hello, Mary.
Hi. I have a problem talking with people about science when they say, well, it's only a theory. And I don't believe they know what theory means in scientific terms. Could you talk about that, please?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Absolutely. That is a common misuse of the word theory by people who generally want to argue against the conclusions that science has. Now, I hear this often when we talk about the theory of evolution. A theory in science, though, is not a guess. It's not, I think that it might be because of such and so. A theory in science is the one explanation that is supported by all the evidence so far. So it is actually the most solid form of knowledge that we have about a given topic. For instance, we have something called the theory of gravity, and we don't really hear people arguing with that one too much.
Yeah. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm going to let you know, Sean Otto, that we've received many phone calls from people who believe that GMOs are not safe. And that's, our phones are ringing off the hook with people talking about wanting to challenge you on that. That's not what this hour is all about, but I'd like you to react to that, that this is something that some people are so passionate about that that's what they want to zero in on.
Oh, yes, I know. Well, this is a perfect confluence of politically engaged reaction to science and public health and that diet and nutrition type of stuff that we were talking about. And it's not without reason that people are suspicious of large corporations, and this is where a lot of this gets conflated, because large corporations often have a bad track record, particularly when it comes to using pesticides. And GMOs in America have gotten really wrapped up in Roundup-resistant crops, crops that are genetically engineered to resist glyphosate, which is then broadly applied to kill all the broadleaf weeds in that same area. But unfortunately, it also tends to cause, we're seeing more and more of this, the evolution, theory of evolution there, of superweeds. So there is a very legitimate concern about the effects that we're having on the environment by using Roundup-ready crops. But that is a different question than the question of whether or not genetically modified food is safe to eat. Now, I'll give you one example. When we're talking about breeding different kinds of plants, there's lots of different processes that you can use. You can use cross-pollination. That's a common term that people have likely heard. But one of the processes you can use is something called mutagenesis, where you take a seed and you bombard it with radiation, cancer-causing radiation, to try to get its genes to change, to mutate. Or you can soak it in cancer-causing chemicals to try to get its genes to mutate. You can then plant that seed and call the resulting plants organic. So some of this comes in the definition of how we cause genes to change. But just because we've changed the way that we are breeding doesn't necessarily mean that we are making things more dangerous to eat, because this is actually just a more precise way of doing what we've done all along. So arguably, we have greater control, and it's even safer.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very separate question from the question of glyphosate use.
And I'm sorry I interrupted you. So just conclude your thought on that.
Well, not just glyphosate use, but also the question of whether or not corporations should control the genomes of living things and what that does economically. And that's a very legitimate concern, but it's not a scientific one.
Right. So you do point a finger at the media for what you say is our role in perpetuating myths and inaccuracy about science in our reporting. So what are we getting wrong?
Well, the biggest problem is this idea that is being taught in J schools all over the country. It comes out of postmodernism that there is no such thing as objectivity. You hear famous media figures even saying it on the speaking circuit, and it's in published reporter guidelines. And while it's very helpful to acknowledge one's own personal biases when reporting, that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as objectivity. And a lot of times I think reporters confuse absolute point of view with objectivity. And all objectivity is it's what we've been able to create as knowledge that is independent of the biases of the reporter. And in that case, reporters really need to be changing how they think about balance and be balancing their stories by telling the story that has the weight of the evidence behind it versus just balancing two different opinions, one informed by evidence and the other not, as if they're equal or of equal merit.
So what kinds of questions should the media be asking, especially our elected officials, when it comes to scientific matters?
What is your evidence? What is the evidence that you are basing this conclusion on? Thomas Jefferson always talked about how we need to do what David Hume and John Locke really favored if we're going to have fair, just public policy, which is to ground our arguments or bottom our arguments out in evidence. And that's really the kind of democracy that he thought would provide justice. And I'm kind of loath to make this comparison, but just what's going on right now with the terrible tragedies in Baton Rouge, Minneapolis, and Dallas, when people feel on both sides that justice is not being served, that we're not relying on evidence, society begins to break down into battles over who has the biggest gun or the most power. And that's the whole reason democracy was created, was to overcome that sort of assertion of power.
By the way, we will be talking about what happened in Dallas last night. Coming up in our Week in Review, we'll have two guests from different perspectives reacting to the sniper shootings of 11 police officers. Five are dead, six others wounded, and we'll talk as well about the police officer-involved shootings of African-American men in Louisiana and Minnesota, and other top stories. That's coming up in our Week in Review after 8 o'clock, and I'm sure Central Time this afternoon after 4 will have more, the very latest on that. Let's go back to the phones. Jerry in Lancaster is with us. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to thank our guest for bringing this topic, you know, to public awareness. I agree with it completely in that politicians or just the political realm can latch on to pseudosciences, especially when it's semi-intuitive and follows with whatever goal they're trying to reach. For example, like the science of eugenics, in the 2030s where they, and 40s where they, you know, find something that kind of fits into science, make it sound scientific, and push it out to the public as something that they want to make a change with using all this scientific evidence where it turns out that it's not, in fact, evidence-based. And, the you know, we continue to see this over and over again.
Well, what about using, I don't know, bad science or purchased science to make bad public policy, Sean Otto?
Well, that's exactly the problem that we're seeing a lot of right now. And when we do that, it's a very different process. It's a process more like, say, a lawyer would approach, where an attorney has a desired outcome that they want to achieve, winning their case. So they will research both sides of an issue called discovery, but they're going to develop arguments against the side that doesn't support winning and present the arguments that do support winning and rely on their opponents to do the same, and then an impartial third party, the judge, the jury, or in Congress, the body as a whole, to make an informed decision. But the problem that we get into when these issues have complex inputs from science is that that's we see battling stakeholders then, each making different assertions, cherry-picking little bits of science, as happened, for instance, in eugenics, taking them out of context, as is happening in climate change. So we see certain scientists arguing that we haven't seen any warming since 1998. We don't know why that is. Well, the reason why that is very simple. It's because they're picking the endpoints, and if you pick a peak to begin with and you point to a trough later on, instead of imagining it like an overall stock chart where it's going up and up, you can prove any point that you want. So this is why we need to get away from that approach of trying to base public policy on the viewpoints of various stakeholders and refocus our conversation back on what is supported most by the evidence.
We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about what we can do to win the war on science. How does science win the war on science, and how can we help if we're inclined to do so? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sean Otto. He is the author of The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. Sean was also the organizer and producer of the last two U.S. presidential science debates in 2008 and 2012. We'll ask, I guess, about some of the science issues on the campaign trail as well when we come back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Sean Otto, who is author of The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. So do you have any examples of evidence of a war on science? Do you have some thoughts on why this is happening or why it matters or what we can do about it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Jean in Madison next. Hi, Jean.
Oh, hi. So thanks for taking my call. I guess I just feel like the problem is really huge, and we've got, you know, I've heard as much as maybe 40% of people, you know, interviewed don't accept evolution, and how we can have a, you know, slate of Republican presidential candidates who will raise their hands that don't accept evolution, and our own governor was, I believe, interviewed by a British journalist that when he punted on that question, and so, you know, the idea that people in this country seem to be willing to accept a lot of dogma, it's really pervasive. I don't know how you get to that foundation of science ignorance in this country.
Yeah, well, is science ignorance at the root of all this, Sean?
There's a lot of evidence to show that it's not ignorance, that when education increases, so does questioning of science. For instance, Pew did a study some years back showing that college-age Republicans, 31% of them accepted the science that humans are causing climate change. Did I say college-educated? High school-educated.
Yes.
By the time they finished college, that number had fallen to 19%. So it actually dropped with more education. And on the other side, there's a higher correlation between wealthy, educated liberals and vaccine refusers over fears on autism. So sometimes what education does is it gives us a sense that we're entitled to question authority, which is good. But then it doesn't necessarily fill in the gaps of how do we make good decisions for ourselves if we are going to question the assertions of authority. And what science really does is it gives us those tools to make those good decisions for ourselves, because it doesn't take anything on faith. It says, show me the evidence, and I'll decide for myself.
Yeah, well, as we talked about earlier, science and religion are at least often portrayed as being at odds with one another. And Gene mentioned, a lot of people, 40% is the figure she used, believe in evolution. Don't believe in evolution. Is there a way to build a more constructive relationship between the two?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let me just say that the more recent numbers show that 52% of Americans think that, for instance, humans and dinosaurs were alive at the same time.
Yeah.
The way to build a more constructive relationship is to remember that science originally grew out of religion. Both of them were explorations of reality. Religion was, at least in Protestantism, was the study of the Book of Revelation versus the Book of Nature. And Puritans preferred studying the Book of Nature, which is where a lot of science grew out of, was the Puritan movement, at least in the West. And the idea of studying nature was considered a truer way of understanding God's complex will. Now, what preachers can do, pastors, ministers, priests today, is they can be members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. There's so much interesting new research that is cutting edge, that has moral and ethical implications, that ministers could be helping guide their flocks in the discussion of, just like they did at the beginning of the scientific revolution. So that's one way that we can really begin to bridge that war, is by having ministers become informed instead of just preaching about the political aspects.
Let's go to Jim in Fontana next. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's just an excellent, excellent program. I've been a teacher and then more recently a writer of children's books and storyteller for almost 40 years now. I'm 70 years old. I've been to hundreds of schools, and when I was in school, the science said that if you expect children to do well, they will. But the teacher's expectations are a huge part of performance. There are even studies like they gave random groups their locker number and told the teachers it was their IQ, and they ended up performing given with those numbers, consistent with those IQ numbers. Because of teacher expectations. This, however, I think is basic science. It's completely ignored in every school I've ever been to. And I've met a lot of fine, wonderful teachers and wonderful schools. Nobody believes that. Teachers, by and large, believe that certain kids are smart and certain kids aren't smart, and then the best ones try to love them and do the best they can.
Okay, that's a little different than what I thought. So Jim wants to know if our educational system is ignoring science too, I think.
Well, there are a lot of issues in our educational system, particularly the focus that has been pushed by social conservatives mostly, on outcomes and on testing, 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 and more testing. Politicians love to meddle with education, and they love to talk about accountability, and their answer is always more testing, it seems, particularly as kids continue to slide relative to in science and math relative to kids in other countries. And one of the ways that we can get around this, and this is something that I talk to teachers about when I get a chance to speak to groups of teachers, is to focus on process, to reignite the fire of education and make it less about regurgitating the right answer and more about exploring the fundamental mysteries of life, which is really what science is about at its core. And there are lots of really cool lesson plans that get into that, because the foundation of education, remember, is you have to raise a level of concern, you create cognitive dissonance so that they think that reality may not be quite what they thought it was, and then you can start to begin to explore the real questions that a good education explores. But teachers' hands are tied, and it's very difficult for them to get into some of these issues, particularly ones that are politically contentious, because the administration worries about calls from parents.
Thank you, Jim. Next, we go to Kurt in Madison. Hello, Kurt.
Oh, hi. Yes, I was just wondering, there was a previous caller who was saying that there were a difference in the body of stakeholders. There was the scientific stakeholders, and then there was the political stakeholders, and that there was some anthropomorphization of the evil other of science as being a disembodied set of other stakeholders. This fallacy of anthropomorphizing science as a body of other, it's a fallacy that I wish people would learn. Critical thought in and of itself is a dying art, and the ability of the average caller to engage in such, I'm sure, as a erudite member of the journalistic class, there I am practicing the habit I am railing against, should have a better understanding of this ability or inability of the public at large to be unable to form these critical arguments. Science is a tool. Politics is an end result. The sky is blue. The ocean is deep. Your host or your guest I think he's missing the mark by half.
Well, I don't, and I'm not sure, Kurt. It's a little unclear as to where you're going. So let me just ask if you want to comment some more specifically on science and politics and how they intersect, Sean.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think part of Kurt's point, if I understood it, was that it related to that identity politics war on science, that tending to regard science as just one of many stakeholders, where really evidence-based thinking should be throughout our policymaking process. Every stakeholder should be basing their arguments on evidence. But when it comes to the media, as he was referencing, I think that sometimes the media gets lost in just the political aspect of this. And let me give you an example of one of your colleagues who, in my opinion, is doing it quite right, and that's a program called The Climate Cast on Minnesota Public Radio, where once a week they never get into the question of whether or not climate change is happening. They take that as a given, and then that allows them to actually explore all the complex but very, very important evidence-based discussions that have to happen for good public policy to emerge.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. I mean, there are some politicians in Wisconsin and elsewhere who might say, you know what, the climate change is happening, I accept that. But the fix is too costly, too drastic for the consequences that could occur because of the climate change. So there's a debate over that. What about that?
Well, that's a legitimate political, economic, and social debate, and that's really where we need to get to. On the other hand, I would disagree with the position put forth when we're talking about three-quarters of the world's coastal cities flooding under several meters of water and becoming unusable, and when we talk about huge economic disruptions like the one that happened in Syria, where much of the problem there has been traced to a drought caused by climate change, directly tied to climate change, Those are enormous economic consequences. And it's hubristic to think that we can't do or shouldn't do anything to change our habits.
So what can individuals do to help and science win the war against it?
Oh, well, one of the things is to reach out to media where they see false balance reporting and challenge them. Contact their ombudsman, contact the editors, and ask them to do a better job of evidence-based reporting so that the public really can make those informed decisions. Another is to challenge their teachers or the administrations of their schools to not teach false science about issues like evolution or climate change, but to really equip parishioners and students for making informed decisions. They can go to sciencedebate.org and sign on to that nonprofit organization's call for candidates for public office to debate these big science, tech, health, and environmental questions that are affecting everyone's lives at the same level that they debate the economic and foreign policy issues.
Well, as we mentioned before, let me just interrupt as we're running out of time. You did produce the last two U.S. presidential science debates, and I understand there's not necessarily one planned, or is there, for this time around?
Right now, we're working with the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, as well as the American Association for the Advancement of Science and 15 other science organizations to craft what the 20 most important questions are. And then we are going to reach out to the candidates again and ask them to engage on those questions, and we'll see if we can organize one.
All right. So, I mean, I'm putting you on the spot, but what is at least a question or an issue that you would want Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to address?
Well, one of the big ones that they're really divided on is this question of climate change. Donald Trump has said several times that he thinks that it's a hoax, a money-making hoax generated by the Chinese. And Hillary Clinton has said that we have to address it in a variety of different ways. So that is one, is what are your views on climate change and how would your administration act on those views?
In our final minute, how hopeful are you that the war on science can be won?
I'm very hopeful with discussion. People in America are smart, and they take in complex information in their public policy dialogue. If we can improve the connection between science on these big issues and the public, I think that we can get there.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Otto is the organizer and producer of the last two U.S. presidential science debates in 2008 and 2012 between President Barack Obama and his opponents, John McCain and Mitt Romney. And he is the author of The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this show. Thanks also to Brianne Chasso and Elizabeth Delaquest for help in producing it. Monday at this time, it's our state capitol report, and after 7, we'll talk with a reporter about what state Democrats might step up to challenge Governor Walker in 2018. That's potential Democratic gubernatorial candidates in 2018 coming up on our state capitol report Monday after 7. Coming up next on the Week in Review, we will talk about many of the top stories in the news. We'll start with the tragic shooting of police officers in Dallas last night. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.